moment, like the ghost of itself on the nearby rise. I sat back and closed my eyes. Then I opened them slowly, savouring this moment for which I had waited too long. He was smiling, seated there as he had been all along, in the far corner of the leather seat opposite. And now he rose with a swift, almost delicate movement, and sat beside me and enfolded me in his arms.
"It's 5 hours to London,"
he whispered in my ear. "I can wait," I said, feeling the thirst like a fever as I held tight to him, feeling his lips against my eyelids and my hair. "I want to hunt the London streets tonight," I confessed, a little shyly, but I saw only approbation in his eyes.
"Beautiful Julie, my Julie,"
he whispered. "You'll love the house in Mayfair," I said.
"Yes,"
he said. "And when Richard finally tires of Rambling Gate, we shall go home."
The Vampire of Kaldenstein by Frederick Cowles. Frederick Ignatius Cowles, 1900 to 1948, was born in Cambridge, England, and graduated from Emmanuel College, Cambridge. He worked for a time at the library of Trinity College, but then moved in 1927 to become chief librarian at Swinton and Pendlebury in Lancashire, a position he held until the end of his life. There he edited the library bulletin, for which he wrote occasional ghost stories. The fact that his grandmother was a gypsy may help account for his many wanderings throughout the British Isles as he researched a series of travel books, including Dust of Years, Pilgrimages in Search of the Ancient Shrines of England, 1933, Neath English Skies, 1933, The Magic of Cornwall, 1934, Not Far from the Smoke, 1935, and Vagabond Pilgrimages, 1948, all of which were illustrated by his talented wife, Doris. He also wrote children's books, including The Magic Map, 1934, and one for his son, Michael in Bookland, 1936. When World War II erupted, he was commissioned a captain. Although unable to join the armed forces because of health problems, he traveled extensively to lecture the troops, further damaging his health. Severe kidney problems were responsible for his death, but not before he was able to publish his most famous book, This is England, 1946. The Vampire of Kaldenstein was originally published in The Night Wind Howls, London, Muller, 1938.
The Vampire of Kaldenstein by Frederick Cowles, read by Jonathan Cowley. Part 1. Since I was a lad, I have been accustomed to spending my vacations wandering about the more remote parts of Europe. I have had some pleasant times in Italy, Spain, Norway, and southern France, but of all the countries I have explored in this fashion, Germany is my favourite. It is an ideal vacation land for the lover of open-air life, whose means are small and taste simple, for the people are always so friendly and the inns are good and cheap. I have had many excellent vacations in Germany, but one will always stand out in my memory because of a very strange and remarkable experience which befell me. It was in the summer of 1933, and I had practically made up my mind to go on a cruise to the Canaries with Donald Young. Then he caught a very childish complaint, the measles in fact, and I was left to make my own arrangements. The idea of joining an organized cruise without a companion did not appeal to me. I am not a particularly sociable kind of person, and these cruises seem to be one round of dances, cocktail parties, and bridge drives. I was afraid of feeling like a fish out of water, so I decided to forego the cruise. Instead, I got out my maps of Germany and began to plan a walking tour. Half the fun of a vacation is in the planning of it, and I suppose I decided on a particular part of the country and changed my mind half a dozen times. At first, I liked the Moselle Valley. Then it was the Lahn. I toyed with the idea of the Black Forest, swung over to the Harz Mountains, and then thought it might be fun to revisit Saxony. Finally, I fixed upon southern Bavaria, because I had never been there and it seemed better to break fresh ground. 2 days of a third-class travel is tiring even for a hardened globetrotter, and I arrived at Munich feeling thoroughly weary and sore. By some good chance, I discovered the Inn of the Golden Apple, near the Hofgarten, where Peter Schmidt sells both good wine and good food, and has a few rooms for the accommodation of guests. Peter, who lived in Canada for 10 years and speaks excellent English, knew exactly how I was feeling. He gave me a comfortable room for 1 mark a night, served me with hot coffee and rolls, and advised me to go to bed and stay there until I was completely rested. I took his advice, slept soundly for 12 hours, and awakened feeling as fresh as a daisy. A dish of roast pork and 2 glasses of lager beer completed the cure, and I sallied forth to see something of Munich. The city is the 4th largest in Germany and has much of interest to show the visitor. The day was well advanced, but I managed to inspect the Frauenkirche with its fine stained glass, the old rat house, and the 14th century church of St. Peter near the Marienplatz. I looked in at the Regina Palast, where a tea dance was in progress, and then went back to the Golden Apple for dinner. Afterward, I attended a performance of Die Meistersinger at the National Theatre. It was past midnight when I retired to bed, and by then I had decided to stay in Munich for another day. I won't bore you with a description of the things I saw and did on that second day. It was just the usual round of sights, with nothing out of the ordinary. After dinner, Peter helped me to plan my tour. He revealed a very intimate knowledge of the Bavarian villages and gave me a list of inns which eventually proved invaluable. It was he who suggested I should take a train to Rosenheim and begin my walk from there. We mapped out a route covering about 200 miles and bringing me back to Munich at the end of 15 days. Well, to cut a long story short, I caught the early morning train to Rosenheim, and a deadly slow journey it was. It took nearly 3 hours to cover a distance of 46 miles. The town itself is quite a cheerful place of the small industrial type, with a 15th century church and a good museum of Bavarian paintings housed in an old chapel. I did not linger there, but started off along the road to Traunstein, a pleasant road curving around the Kayamsee, the largest lake in Bavaria. I spent the night at Traunstein, and the next day pushed on to the old walled town of Mulldorf. From there, I planned to make for Wilshofen by way of Pfarrkirchen. But I took a wrong turning and found myself in a small place called Gunkofen. The local innkeeper tried to be helpful and directed me to a field path which he said would prove a short cut to Pfarrkirchen. Evidently, I misunderstood his instructions, for evening came, and I was hopelessly lost in the heart of a range of low hills which were not marked on my map. Darkness was falling when I came upon a small village huddled under the shadow of a high cliff, upon which stood a grey stone castle. Fortunately, the village possessed an inn, a primitive place, but moderately comfortable. The landlord was an intelligent kind of chap and friendly enough, although he informed me that visitors were seldom seen in the district. The name of the hamlet was Koldenstein. I was served with a simple meal of goat's milk cheese, salad, coarse bread, and a bottle of thin red wine, and having done justice to the spread, went for a short stroll. The moon had risen and the castle stood out against a cloudless sky like some magic castle in a fairy tale. It was only a small building, square with 4 turrets, but it was the most romantic-looking fortress I had ever seen. A light twinkled in one of the windows, so I knew the place was inhabited. A steep path and a flight of steps cut in the rock led up to it, and I half considered paying the Lord of Koldenstein a late visit. Instead, I returned to the inn and joined the few men who were drinking in the public room. The company was mainly composed of folk of the labouring class, and although they were polite, they had little of that friendly spirit one is accustomed to meet with in German villages. They seemed morose and unresponsive, and I had the impression that they shared some dread secret. I did my best to engage them in conversation without success. Then, to get one of them to speak, I asked, "Tell me, my friends, who lives in the castle on the hillside?" The effect of the harmless question upon them was startling. Those who were drinking placed their beer mugs on the table and gazed at me with consternation on their faces. Some made the sign of the cross, and one old chap hoarsely whispered, "Silence, stranger! God forbid that he should hear!" My inquiry seemed to have upset them altogether, and within 10 minutes they all left in a group. I apologized to the landlord for any indiscretion I had been guilty of, and hoped my presence had not robbed him of custom. He waved aside my excuses and assured me that the men would not have stayed long in any case. "They are terrified of any mention of the castle," he said, "and consider it unlucky to even glance at the building after nightfall." "But why?" I inquired. "Who lives there?" "It is the home of Count Ludwig von Kaldenstein." "And how long has he lived up there?" I asked. The man moved over to the door and carefully shut and barred it before he replied. Then he came over to my chair and whispered, "He has been up there for nearly 300 years. "Nonsense!" I exclaimed, laughing. "How can any man, be he count or peasant, live for 300 years? I suppose you mean that his family has held the castle for that length of time." "I mean exactly what I say, young man," answered the old fellow earnestly. "The count's family has held the castle for 10 centuries, and the count himself has dwelt in Burg Kaldenstein for nearly 300 years.
"But how can that be possible?"
"He is a vampire. Deep down in the castle rock are great vaults, and in one of these the count sleeps during the day, and so that the sunlight may not touch him. Only at night does he walk outside." This was too fantastic for anything. I am afraid I smiled in a skeptical manner, but the poor landlord was obviously very serious, and I hesitated to make another remark that might wound his feelings. I finished my beer and got up to go to bed. As I was mounting the stairs, my host called me back and, grasping my arm, said, "Please, sir, let me beg you to keep your window closed. The night air of Kaldenstein is not healthy." On reaching my room, I found the window already tightly shut, although the atmosphere was like that of an oven. Of course, I opened it at once and leaned out to fill my lungs with fresh air. The window looked directly upon the castle, and, in the clear light of the full moon, the building appeared more than ever like some dream of fairyland. I was just drawing back into the room when I thought I saw a black figure silhouetted against the sky on the summit of one of the turrets. Even as I watched, it flapped enormous wings and soared into the night. It seemed too large for an eagle, but the moonlight has an odd trick of distorting shapes. I watched until it was only a tiny black speck in the far distance. Just then, from far away, a dog howled weirdly and mournfully. Within a few moments, I was ready for bed, and disregarding the innkeeper's warning, I left the window open. I took my electric flashlight from my rucksack and placed it on the small bedside table, a table above which hung a wooden crucifix. I'm usually asleep as soon as my head touches the pillow, but on this particular night I found it difficult to settle. The moonlight disturbed me and I tossed about, vainly trying to get comfortable. I counted sheep until I was heartily sick of imagining the silly creatures passing through a gap in a hedge, but still sleep eluded me. A clock in the house chimed the hour of midnight, and suddenly I had the unpleasant feeling that I was no longer alone. For a moment, I felt frightened, and then, overcoming my fear, I turned over. There, by the window, and black against the moonlight, was the figure of a tall man. I started up in bed and groped for my flashlight. In doing so, I knocked something from the wall. It was the little crucifix, and my fingers closed over it almost as soon as it touched the table. From the direction of the window came a muttered curse, and I saw the figure poise itself on the sill and spring out into the night. In that brief moment, I noticed one other thing. The man, whoever he was, cast no shadow. The moonlight seemed to stream right through him. It must have been almost half an hour before I dared get out of bed and close the window. After that, I fell asleep immediately and slept soundly until the maid called me at 8 o'clock. In the broad daylight, the events of the night seemed too ridiculous to be true, and I decided that I had been the victim of some fantastic nightmare. In answer to the landlord's polite inquiry, I vowed I had spent a most comfortable night, although I'm afraid my looks must have belied the statement. Part 2. After breakfast, I went out to explore the village. It was rather larger than it had appeared on the previous evening, with some of the houses lying in a valley at the side of the road. There was even a small church, Romanesque in type and sadly in need of repair. I entered the building and was inspecting its gaudy high altar when a priest came in through a side door. He was a lean, ascetic-looking man and at once gave me a friendly greeting. I returned his salutation and told him I was from England. He apologized for the obvious poverty of the building, pointed out some good 15th-century glass, a carved font of the same period, and a very pleasing statue of the Madonna. Later, as I stood at the church door with him, I looked toward the castle and said, "I wonder, Father, if the Lord of Kaldenstein will give me a welcome as friendly as the one I have received from you." "The Lord of Kaldenstein," repeated the priest with a tremor in his voice. "Surely you are not proposing to visit the castle." "That is my intention," I replied. "It looks a very interesting place, and I should be sorry to leave this part of the world without seeing it." "Let me implore you not to attempt to enter that accursed place," he pleaded. "Visitors are not welcomed at Kaldenstein Castle. Besides that," he went on with a change in his voice, "there is nothing to see in the building." "What about the wonderful vaults in the cliff and the man who has lived in them for 300 years, I laughed. The priest's face visibly blanched. "Then you know of the vampire," he said. "Do not laugh at evil, my son. May God preserve us all from the living dead." He made the sign of the cross. "But Father," I cried, "surely you do not believe in such a medieval superstition." "Every man believes what he knows to be true. And we of Kaldenstein can prove that no burial has taken place in the castle since 1645, when Count Fyodor died and his cousin Ludwig from Hungary inherited the estate." "Such a tale is too absurd," I remonstrated. "There must be some reasonable explanation of the mystery. It is unthinkable that a man who came to this place in 1645 can still be alive." "Much is possible to those who serve the devil," answered the priest. "Always throughout the history of the world, evil has warred with good, and often triumphed. Kaldenstein Castle is the haunt of terrible, unnatural wickedness, and I urge you to keep as far away from it as you can." He bade me a courteous farewell, lifted his hand in a gentle benediction, and re-entered the church. Now I must confess that the priest's words gave me a most uncomfortable feeling and made me think of my nightmare. Had it been a dream after all? Or could it have been the vampire himself seeking to make me one of his victims and only being frustrated in his plan by my accidental gripping of the crucifix?
These thoughts passed through my mind, and I almost abandoned my resolve to seek admittance to the castle. Then I looked up again at the grey old walls gleaming in the morning sunshine, and laughed at my fears. No mythical monster from the Middle Ages was going to frighten me away. The priest was just as superstitious as his ignorant parishioners. Whistling a popular song, I made my way up the village street and was soon climbing the narrow path which led to the castle. As the ascent became steeper, the path gave place to a flight of steps which brought me onto a small plateau before the main door of the building. There was no sign of life about the place, but a ponderous bell hung before the entrance. I pulled a rusty chain and set the cracked thing jangling. The sound disturbed a colony of rooks in one of the turrets and started them chattering, but no human being appeared to answer my summons. Again, I set the bell ringing. This time, the echoes had hardly died away when I heard bolts being withdrawn. The great door creaked on its hinges, and an old man stood blinking in the sunlight.
"Who comes to Castle Kaldenstein?" he asked in a curious, high-pitched voice, and I could see that he was half-blind.
"I am an English visitor," I answered, "and would like to see the Count."
"His Excellency does not receive visitors," was the reply, and the man made to close the door in my face.
"But is it not permitted that I should see over the castle?" I asked hurriedly. "I am interested in medieval fortresses, and should be sorry to leave Kaldenstein without inspecting this splendid building." The old fellow peered out at me, and in a hesitant voice said,
"There is little to see, sir, and I am afraid you would only be wasting your time."
"Yet I should appreciate the privilege of a brief visit," I argued, "and I am sure that the Count would not object. I do assure you I shall not be a nuisance, and I have no desire to disturb His Excellency's privacy."
"What is the hour?" asked the man.
I informed him that it was barely 11 o'clock. He muttered something about it being
safe while the sun is in the sky,
and motioned me to enter. I found myself in a bare hall, hung with rotting tapestry and smelling of damp and decay. At the end of the room was a canopied dais surmounted by a coat of arms.
"This is the main hall of the castle," mumbled my guide, "and it has witnessed many great historic scenes in the days of the great lords of Kaldenstein. Here, Frederick, the 6th Count, put out the eyes of 12 Italian hostages and afterward had them driven over the edge of the cliff. Here, Count August is said to have poisoned a prince of Württemberg and then sat at a feast with the dead body."
He went on with his tales of foul and treacherous deeds, and it was evident that the Counts of Kaldenstein must have been a very unsavory lot. From the main hall he conducted me into a number of smaller rooms filled with mouldering furniture. His own quarters were in the north turret, but although he showed me over the whole building, I saw no room in which his master could be. The old fellow opened every door without hesitation, and it seemed that except for himself, the castle was untenanted. "But where is the Count's room?" I inquired as we returned to the main hall. He looked confused for a moment and then replied,
"We have certain underground apartments, and His Excellency uses one as his bedchamber. You see, he can rest there undisturbed."
I thought that any room in the building would give him the quietness he required, without having to seek peace in the bowels of the earth. "And have you no private chapel?" I asked.
"The chapel is also below."
I intimated that I was interested in chapels, and should very much like to see an example of an underground place of worship. The old man made several excuses, but at last consented to show me the crypt. Taking an old-fashioned lantern from a shelf, he lit the candle in it, and lifting a portion of the tapestry from the wall, opened a hidden door. A sickly odour of damp corruption swept up at us. Muttering to himself, he led the way down a flight of stone steps and along a passage hollowed in the rock. At the end of this was another door which admitted us to a large cavern furnished like a church.
The place stank like a charnel house, and the feeble light of the lantern only intensified the gloom. My guide led me toward the chancel, and lifting the light, pointed out a particularly revolting painting of Lazarus rising from the dead, which hung above the altar. I moved forward to examine it more closely, and found myself near another door. "And what is beyond this?"
"Speak softly, sir," he implored. "It is the vault in which rest the mortal remains of the lords of Koldenstein."
And while he was speaking, I heard a sound from beyond that barrier, a sigh, and the kind of noise that might be made by a person turning in his sleep. I think the old servitor also heard it, for he grasped me with a trembling hand and led me out of the chapel. His flickering light went before me as I mounted the stairs, and I laughed sharply with relief as we stepped into the castle hall again. He gave me a quick look and said,
"That is all, sir. You see, there is little of interest in this old building."
I tried to press a 5-mark piece into his hand, but he refused to accept it.
"Money is of no use to me, sir," he whispered. "I have nothing to spend it on, for I live with the dead. Give the coin to the priest in the village, and ask him to say a mass for me, if you will."
I promised it should be done as he desired, and then in some mad spirit of bravado asked, "And when does the Count receive visitors?"
"My master never receives visitors," was the reply.
"But surely he is sometimes in the castle itself. He doesn't spend all his time in the vaults," I urged.
"Usually, after nightfall, he sits in the hall for an hour or so, and sometimes walks on the battlements."
"Then I shall be back tonight," I cried. "I owe it to His Excellency to pay my respects to him." The old man turned in the act of unfastening the door, and fixing his dim eyes upon my face, said,
"Come not to Koldenstein after the sun has set, lest you find that which shall fill your heart with fear."
"Don't try to frighten me with any of your hobgoblins," I rudely replied. Then raising my voice, I cried, "Tonight I shall wait upon the Count von Koldenstein." The servant flung the door wide, and the sunlight streamed into the mouldering building.
"If you come, he will be ready to receive you," he said. "And remember that if you enter the castle again, you do so of your own free will."
Part 3. By the time evening came, my courage had quite evaporated, and I wished I had taken the priest's advice and left Koldenstein. But there is a streak of obstinacy in my makeup, and having vowed to visit the castle again, nothing could turn me from my purpose. I waited until dusk had fallen, and saying nothing to the innkeeper of my intentions, made my way up the steep path to the fortress. The moon had not yet risen, and I had to use my flashlight on the steps. I rang the cracked bell, and the door opened almost immediately. There stood the old servant, bowing a welcome.
"His Excellency will see you, sir," he cried. "Enter Koldenstein Castle. Enter of your own free will."
For 1 second I hesitated. Something seemed to warn me to retreat while there was still time. Then I plucked up courage and stepped over the threshold. A log fire was burning in the enormous grate and gave a more cheerful atmosphere to the gloomy apartment. Candles gleamed in the silver candelabra, and I saw that a man was sitting at the table on the dais. As I advanced, he came down to greet me. How shall I describe the Count of Koldenstein? He was unusually tall, with a face of unnatural pallor. His hair was intensely black, and his hands delicately shaped, but with very pointed fingers and long nails. His eyes impressed me most. As he crossed the room, they seemed to glow with a red light, just as if the pupils were ringed with flame. However, his greeting was conventional enough.
"Welcome to my humble home, sir," he said, bowing very low. "I regret my inability to offer you a more hospitable welcome, but we live very frugally. It is seldom we entertain guests, and I am honored that you should take the trouble to call upon me." I murmured some polite word of thanks, and he conducted me to a seat at the long table, upon which stood a decanter and one glass. "You will take wine," he invited, and filled the glass to the brim. It was a rare old vintage, but I felt a little uncomfortable at having to drink alone. "I trust you will excuse me for not joining you," he said, evidently noticing my hesitant manner. "I never drink wine," he smiled, and I saw that his front teeth were long and sharply pointed. "And now tell me," he went on, "what are you doing in this part of the world? Kaldenstein is rather off the beaten track, and we seldom see strangers." I explained that I was on a walking tour and had missed my way to Far Kirchen. The Count laughed softly and again showed his fang-like teeth. "And so you came to Kaldenstein, and of your own free will you have come to visit me." I began to dislike these references to my free will. The expression seemed to be a kind of formula. The servant had used it when I was leaving after my morning visit, and again when he had admitted me that evening, and now the Count was making use of it. "How else should I come but of my own free will?" I asked sharply. "In the bad old days of the past, many have been brought to this castle by force. The only guests we welcome today are those who come willingly." All this time a queer sensation was gradually coming over me. I felt as if all my energy was being sapped from me, and a deadly nausea was overpowering my senses. The Count went on uttering commonplaces, but his voice came from far away. I was conscious of his peculiar eyes gazing into mine. They grew larger and larger, and it seemed that I was looking into two wells of fire. And then, with a clumsy movement, I knocked my wine glass over. The frail thing shattered to fragments, and the noise restored me to my senses. A splinter pierced my hand, and a tiny pool of blood formed on the table. I sought for a handkerchief, but before I could produce it, I was terrified by an unearthly howl which echoed through the vaulted hall. The cry came from the lips of the Count, and in a moment he was bending over the blood on the table, licking it up with obvious relish. A more disgusting sight that I have never witnessed, and, struggling to my feet, I made for the door. But terror weakened my limbs, and the Count had overtaken me before I had covered many yards. His white hands grasped my arms and led me back to the chair I had vacated. "My dear sir," he said, "I must beg you to excuse me for my discourtesy. The members of my family have always been peculiarly affected by the sight of blood. Call it an idiosyncrasy if you like, but it does at times make us behave like vile animals. I am grieved to have so far forgotten my manners as to behave in such a strange way before a guest. I assure you that I have sought to conquer this failing, and for that reason I keep away from my fellow men." The explanation seemed plausible enough, but it filled me with horror and loathing, more especially as I could see a tiny globule of blood clinging to his mouth. "I fear I am keeping your excellency from bed," I suggested, "and in any case, I think it is time I got back to the inn."
"Ah, no, my friend," he replied. "The night hours are the ones I enjoy best, and I shall be very grateful if you will remain with me until morning. The castle is a lonely place, and your company will be a pleasant change. There is a room prepared for you in the south turret, and tomorrow, who knows, there may be other guests to cheer us." A deadly fear gripped my heart, and I staggered to my feet, stammering, "Let me go! Let me go! I must return to the village at once."
"You cannot return tonight, for a storm is brewing and the cliff path will be unsafe."
As he uttered these words, he crossed to a window and, flinging it open, raised one arm toward the sky. As if in obedience to his gesture, a flash of vivid lightning split the clouds, and a clap of thunder seemed to shake the castle. Then the rain came in a terrible deluge, and a great wind howled across the mountains. The Count closed the casement and returned to the table.
"You see, my friend," he chuckled, "the very elements are against your return to the village. You must be satisfied with such poor hospitality as we can offer you, for tonight at any rate."
The red-rimmed eyes met mine, and again I felt my will being sapped from my body. His voice was no more than a whisper, and seemed to come from far away.
"Follow me, and I will conduct you to your room. You are my guest for tonight."
He took a candle from the table, and like a man in a trance, I followed him up a winding staircase, along an empty corridor, and into a cheerless room furnished with an ancient four-poster bed.
"Sleep well," he said with a wicked leer. "Tomorrow night you shall have other company."
The heavy door slammed behind him as he left me alone, and I heard a bolt being shot on the other side. Summoning what little strength was left in my body, I hurled myself against the door. It was securely fastened, and I was a prisoner. Through the keyhole came the Count's purring voice.
"Yes, you shall have other company tomorrow night. The lords of Kaldenstein shall give you a hearty welcome to their ancestral home."
A burst of mocking laughter died away in the distance as I fell to the floor in a dead faint. Part 4. I must have recovered somewhat after a time and dragged myself to the bed and again sunk into unconsciousness, for when I came around, daylight was streaming through the barred window of the room. I looked at my wristwatch. It was 3:30, and by the sun it was afternoon, so the greater part of the day had passed. I still felt weak, but struggled over to the window. It looked out upon the craggy slopes of the mountain, and there was no human habitation in sight. With a moan, I returned to the bed and tried to pray. I watched the patch of sunlight on the floor grow fainter and fainter until it had faded altogether. Then the shadows gathered, and at last, only the dim outline of the window remained. The darkness filled my soul with a new terror, and I lay on the bed in a cold, clammy sweat. Then I heard footsteps approaching. The door was flung open, and the Count entered bearing a candle.
"You must pardon me for what may seem a shocking lack of manners on my part," he exclaimed, "but necessity compels me to keep to my chamber during the day. Now, however, I am able to offer you some entertainment."
I tried to rise, but my limbs refused to function. With a mirthless laugh, he placed one arm around my waist and lifted me with as little effort as if I were a baby. In this fashion, he carried me across the corridor and down the stairs into the hall. Only 3 candles burned on the table, and I could see little of the room for some moments after he had dumped me into a chair. Then, as my eyes became accustomed to the gloom, I realized that there were 2 other guests at that board. The feeble light flickered on their faces, and I almost screamed with terror. I looked upon the ghastly countenances of dead men, every feature stamped with evil, and their eyes glowed with the same hellish light that shone in the Count's eyes.
"Allow me to introduce my uncle and my cousin," said my jailer. "August von Kaldenstein and Fyodor von Kaldenstein."
"But," I blurted out, "I was told that Count Fyodor died in 1645. The 3 terrible creatures laughed heartily, as if I had recounted a good joke. Then August leaned over the table and pinched the fleshy part of my arm.
"He is full of good blood," he chuckled. "This feast has been long promised, Ludwig, but I think it has been worth waiting for."
I must have fainted at that, and when I came to myself, I was lying on the table and the three were bending over me. Their voices came in sibilant whispers.
"The throat must be mine," said the Count. "I claim the throat as my privilege."
"It should be mine," muttered August. "I am the eldest, and it is long since I fed. Yet I am content to have the breast."
"The legs are mine," croaked the third monster. "Legs are always full of rich red blood."
Their lips were drawn back like the lips of animals, and their white fangs gleamed in the candlelight. Suddenly, a clanging sound disturbed the silence of the night. It was the castle bell. The creatures darted to the back of the dais, and I could hear them muttering. Then the bell gave a more persistent peal.
"We are powerless against it," the Count cried. "Back to your retreat."
His two companions vanished through the small door which led to the underground chapel, and the Count of Koldenstein stood alone in the centre of the room. I raised myself into a sitting posture, and as I did so, I heard a strong voice calling beyond the main door.
"Open, in the name of God," it thundered. "Open, by the power of the ever-blessed sacrament of the altar."
As if drawn by some overwhelming force, the Count approached the door and loosened the bolts. It was immediately flung open, and there stood the tall figure of the parish priest, bearing aloft something in a silver box like a watch. With him was the innkeeper, and I could see the poor fellow was terrified. The two advanced into the hall, and the Count retreated before them.
"Thrice in 10 years have I frustrated you by the power of God," cried the priest. "Thrice has the holy sacrament been carried into this house of sin. Be warned in time, accursed man. Back to your foul tomb, creature of Satan. Back, I command you."
With a strange whimpering cry, the Count vanished through the small door, and the priest came over and assisted me from the table. The innkeeper produced a flask and forced some brandy between my lips, and I made an effort to stand.
"Foolish boy," said the priest, "you would not take my warning, and see what your folly has brought you to."
They helped me out of the castle and down the steps, but I collapsed before we reached the inn. I have a vague recollection of being helped into bed and remember nothing more until I awakened in the morning. The priest and the innkeeper were awaiting me in the dining room, and we breakfasted together. "What is the meaning of it all, Father?" I asked after the meal had been served.
"It is exactly as I told you," was the reply. "The Count of Koldenstein is a vampire. He keeps the semblance of life in his evil body by drinking human blood. 8 years ago, a headstrong youth, like yourself, determined to visit the castle. He did not return within reasonable time, and I had to save him from the clutches of the monster. Only by carrying with me the body of Christ was I able to effect an entrance, and I was just in time. Then, 2 years later, a woman who professed to believe in neither God nor the devil made up her mind to see the Count. Again, I was forced to bear the Blessed Sacrament into the castle, and by its power overcame the forces of Satan. 2 days since, I watched you climb the cliff and saw, with relief, that you returned safely. But yesterday morning, Heinrich came to inform me that your bed had not been slept in, and he was afraid the Count had got you. We waited until nightfall, and then made our way up to the castle. The rest you know.
I can never thank you both sufficiently for the manner in which you saved me from those creatures," I said.
"Creatures," repeated the priest in a surprised voice. "Surely there is only the Count. The servant does not share his master's bloodlust."
"No, I did not see the servant after he had admitted me. But there were two others, August and Fyodor."
"August and Fyodor," he murmured. "Then it is worse than we have ever dreamed. August died in 1572, and Fyodor in 1645. Both were monsters of iniquity, but I did not suspect that they were numbered among the living dead.
Father, quavered the innkeeper, we are not safe in our beds. Can we not call upon the government to rid us of these vampires?
The government would laugh at us, was the reply. We must take the law into our own hands.
What is to be done? I asked.
I wonder if you have the courage to see this ghastly business through, and to witness a sight that will seem incredible.
I assured him I was willing to do anything to help, for I considered I owed my life to him.
Then, he said, I will return to the church for a few things, and we will go up to the castle. Will you come with us, Heinrich?
The innkeeper hesitated just a moment, but it was evident that he had the greatest confidence in the priest, and he answered,
Of course I will, Father.
It was almost midday when we set off on our mysterious mission. The castle door stood wide open, exactly as we had left it on the previous night, and the hall was deserted. We soon discovered the door under the tapestry, and the priest, with a powerful electric flashlight in his hand, led the way down the damp steps. At the chapel door, he paused, and from his robes drew three crucifixes and a vessel of holy water. To each of us he handed one of the crosses and sprinkled the door with the water. Then he opened it, and we entered the cavern. With hardly a glance at the altar and its gruesome painting, he made his way to the entrance of the vault. It was locked, but he burst the catch with a powerful kick. A wave of fetid air leaped out at us, and we staggered back. Then, lifting his crucifix before him and crying,
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost,
the priest led us into the tomb. I do not know what I expected to see, but I gave a gasp of horror as the light revealed the interior of the place. In the center, resting on a wooden bier, was the sleeping body of the Count of Koldenstein. His red lips were parted in a smile, and his wicked eyes were half open. Around the vault, niches contained coffins, and the priest examined each in turn. Then he directed us to lift two of them to the floor. I noticed that one bore the name of August von Koldenstein, and the other that of Fyodor. It took all our united strength to move the caskets, but at last we had them down. And all the time the eyes of the Count seemed to be watching us, although he never moved.
Now, whispered the priest, the most ghastly part of the business begins.
Producing a large screwdriver, he began to prise off the lid of the first coffin. Soon it was loose, and he motioned us to raise it. Inside was Count August, looking exactly as I had seen him the previous night. His red-rimmed eyes were wide open and gleamed wickedly, and the stench of corruption hung about him. The priest set to work on the second casket, and soon revealed the body of Count Fyodor, with his matted hair hanging about his white face. Then began a strange ceremony. Taking the crucifixes from us, the priest laid them upon the breasts of the two bodies, and producing his breviary, recited some Latin prayers. Finally, he stood back and flung holy water into the coffins. As the drops touched the leering corpses, they appeared to writhe in agony, to swell as though they were about to burst, and then, before our eyes, they crumbled into dust. Silently, we replaced the lids on the coffins and restored them to their niches.
And now, said the priest, we are powerless. Ludwig von Koldenstein, by evil arts, has conquered death. For the time being, at any rate, and we cannot treat him as we have treated these creatures, whose vitality was only a semblance of life. We can but pray that God will curb the activities of this monster of sin.
So saying, he laid the third cross upon the Count's breast, and sprinkling him with holy water, uttered a Latin prayer. With that, we left the vault, but, as the door clanged behind us, something fell on the ground inside the place. It must have been the crucifix falling from the Count's breast.
We made our way up into the castle, and never did God's good air taste sweeter. All this time, we had seen no sign of the old servant, and I suggested we should try to discover him. His quarters, I remembered, were in the north turret. There, we found his crooked old body, hanging by the neck from a beam in the roof. He had been dead for at least 24 hours, and the priest said that nothing could be done other than to notify his death to the proper quarter and arrange for the funeral to take place. I am still puzzled about the mystery of Koldenstein Castle. The fact that Count August and Count Feodor had become vampires after death, although it sounds fantastic enough, is more easily understandable than Count Ludwig's seeming immunity from death. The priest could not explain the matter, and appeared to think that the Count might go on living and troubling the neighbourhood for an indefinite period. One thing I do know. On that last night at Koldenstein, I opened my window before retiring to bed and looked out upon the castle. At the top of one of the turrets, clear in the bright moonlight, stood a black figure, the shadowy form of the Count of Koldenstein. Little more remains to be told. Of course, my stay in the village threw all my plans out, and by the time I arrived back at Munich, my tour had taken nearly 20 days. Peter Schmidt laughed at me and wondered what blue-eyed maiden had caused me to linger in some Bavarian village. I didn't tell him that the real causes of the delay had been 2 dead men and a third who, by all natural laws, should have been dead long ago.
An episode of Cathedral History by M.R. James. Montague Rhodes James, 1862-1936, was born in Kent, moving to Suffolk at the age of 3, where he lived at the rectory in Great Livermere for many years and set several of his ghost stories there. He studied at Cambridge University, living there as an undergraduate, then as a don and provost at King's College, also setting several stories there. While remembered today mainly as arguably the greatest writer of ghost stories who ever lived, he was also a medieval scholar of prodigious knowledge and productivity, having catalogued many of the libraries of Cambridge and Oxford, and being responsible, after the discovery of a manuscript fragment, for rediscovering the graves of several 12th-century abbots. Among his scholarly publications are several about the Apocrypha. His greatest macabre stories are generally regarded to have been published in his first 2 collections— Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, 1904, and More Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, 1911. Also published in his lifetime were A Thin Ghost and Others, 1919, A Warning to the Curious and Other Ghost Stories, 1925, Wailing Well, 1928, and The Collected Ghost Stories of M.R. James, 1931. For more on M.R. James, see the introductory notes to Count Magnus. An episode of Cathedral History was first published in the June 10, 1914 issue of Cambridge Review. It was first published in book form in A Thin Ghost, London, Edward Arnold, 1919.
An episode of Cathedral History by M. R. James. Read by Simon Vance. There was once a learned gentleman who was deputed to examine and report upon the archives of the Cathedral of Southminster. The examination of these records demanded a very considerable expenditure of time. Hence it became advisable for him to engage lodgings in the city. For though the cathedral body were profuse in their offers of hospitality, Mr. Lake felt that he would prefer to be master of his day. This was recognized as reasonable. The dean eventually wrote advising Mr. Lake, if he were not already suited, to communicate with Mr. Warby, the principal verger, who occupied a house convenient to the church and was prepared to take in a quiet lodger for 3 or 4 weeks. Such an arrangement was precisely what Mr. Lake desired. Terms were easily agreed upon, and early in December, like another Mr. Datchery, as he remarked to himself, the investigator found himself in the occupation of a very comfortable room in an ancient and cathedrally house. One so familiar with the customs of cathedral churches and treated with such obvious consideration by the dean and chapter of this cathedral in particular, could not fail to command the respect of the head verger. Mr. Warby even acquiesced in certain modifications of statements he had been accustomed to offer for years to parties of visitors. Mr. Lake, on his part, found the verger a very cheery companion, and took advantage of any occasion that presented itself for enjoying his conversation when the day's work was over. One evening, about 9 o'clock, Mr. Warby knocked at his lodger's door. "I've occasion," he said, "to go across to the cathedral, Mr. Lake, and I think I made you a promise, when I did so next, I would give you the opportunity to see what it looked like at night-time. It's quite fine and dry outside, if you care to come." "To be sure I will. Very much obliged to you, Mr. Warby, for thinking of it, but let me get my coat. Here it is, sir, and I've another lantern here that you'll find advisable for the steps, as there's no moon." "Anyone might think we were Jasper and Durdles over again, mightn't they?" said Lake, as they crossed the close, for he had ascertained that the verger had read Edwin Drood. "Well, so they might," said Mr. Warby, with a short laugh, "though I don't know whether we ought to take it as a compliment. Odd ways, I often think, they had at that cathedral. Don't it seem so to you, sir? Full choral matins at 7 o'clock in the morning all the year round. Wouldn't suit our boys' voices nowadays. And I think there's one or two other men would be applying for a rise if the chapter was to bring it in, particularly the altos." They were now at the southwest door. As Mr. Warby was unlocking it, Lake said, "Did you ever find anybody locked in here by accident?" "Twice I did. Once was a drunk sailor. However he got in, I don't know. I suppose he went to sleep in the service. But by the time I got to him, he was praying fit to bring the roof in. Lord, what a noise that man did make! Said it was the first time he'd been inside a church for 10 years, and blessed if ever he'd try it again. The other was an old sheep. Them boys it was up to their games. That was the last time they tried it on, though. There, sir, now you see what we look like. Our late dean used now and again to bring parties in, but he preferred a moonlit night, and there was a piece of verse he'd say to 'em, relating to a Scotch cathedral, I understand. But I don't know. I almost think the effect's better when it's all dark-like. Seems to add to the size and height. Now, if you won't mind stopping somewhere in the nave while I go up into the choir where my business lays, you'll see what I mean." Accordingly, Lake waited, leaning against a pillar, and watched the light wavering along the length of the church and up the steps into the choir, until it was intercepted by some screen or other furniture which only allowed the reflection to be seen on the piers and roof. Not many minutes had passed before Warby reappeared at the door of the choir, and by waving his lantern signalled to Lake to rejoin him. "I suppose it is Warby, and not a substitute," thought Lake to himself, as he walked up the nave. There was, in fact, nothing untoward. Warby showed him the papers which he had come to fetch out of the dean's stall, and asked him what he thought of the spectacle. Lake agreed that it was well worth seeing. "I suppose," he said as they walked towards the altar steps together, "that you're too much used to going about here at night to feel nervous. But you must get a start every now and then, don't you? When a book falls down or a door swings to?" "No, Mr. Lake, I can't say I think much about noises, not nowadays. I'm much more afraid of finding an escape of gas or a burst in the stovepipes than anything else. Still, there have been times, years ago. Did you notice that plain altar tomb there? 15th century, we say it is. I don't know if you agree to that. Well, if you didn't look at it, just come back and give it a glance, if you be so good." It was on the north side of the choir, and rather awkwardly placed, only about 3 feet from the enclosing stone screen. Quite plain, as the verger had said, but for some ordinary stone panelling. A metal cross of some size on the northern side, that next to the screen, was the solitary feature of any interest. Lake agreed that it was not earlier than the Perpendicular period. "But," he said, "unless it's the tomb of some remarkable person, you'll forgive me for saying that I don't think it's particularly noteworthy." "Well, I can't say as it is the tomb of anybody noted in history," said Warby, who had a dry smile on his face, "for we don't own any record whatsoever of who it was put up to. For all that, if you've half an hour to spare, sir, when we get back to the house, Mr. Lake, I could tell you a tale about that tomb. I won't begin on it now. It strikes cold here, and we don't want to be dawdling about all night. Of course, I should like to hear it immensely." "Very well, sir, you shall. Now, if I might put a question to you," he went on, as they passed down the choir aisle. "In our little local guide, and not only there, but in the little book on our cathedral in the series, you'll find it stated that this portion of the building was erected previous to the 12th century. Now, of course, I shall be glad enough to take that view, but, mind the step, sir, but I put it to you, does the lay of the stone here in this portion of the wall," which he tapped with his key, "does it to your eye carry the flavour of what you might call Saxon masonry?" "No, I thought not. No more it does to me. Now, if you'll believe me, I've said as much to those men. One's the librarian of our free library here, and the other came down from London on purpose, 50 times, if I have once. But I might just as well have talked to that bit of stonework. But there it is. I suppose everyone's got their opinions." The discussion of this peculiar trait of human nature occupied Mr. Warby almost up to the moment when he and Lake re-entered the former's house. The condition of the fire in Lake's sitting-room led to a suggestion from Mr. Warby that they should finish the evening in his own parlour. We find them accordingly settled there some short time afterwards. Mr. Warby made his story a long one, and I will not undertake to tell it wholly in his own words, or in his own order. Lake committed the substance of it to paper immediately after hearing it, together with some few passages of the narrative which had fixed themselves verbatim in his mind. I shall probably find it expedient to condense Lake's record to some extent. Mr. Warby was born, it appeared, about the year 1828. His father before him had been connected with the cathedral, and likewise his grandfather. One or both had been choristers, and in later life both had done work as mason and carpenter respectively about the fabric. Warby himself, though possessed, as he frankly acknowledged, of an indifferent voice, had been drafted into the choir at about 10 years of age. It was in 1840 that the wave of the Gothic revival smote the Cathedral of Southminster. "There was a lot of lovely stuff went then, sir," said Warby with a sigh. "My father couldn't hardly believe it when he got his orders to clear out the choir. There was a new dean just come in, Dean Burscough it was, and my father had been prenticed to a good firm of joiners in the city and knew what good work was when he saw it. Cruel it was, he used to say. All that beautiful wainscot oak, as good as the day it was put up, and garlands like of foliage and fruit, and lovely old gilding work on the coats of arms and the organ pipes. All went to the timber yard. Every bit except some little pieces worked up in the lady chapel and here in this overmantel. Well, I may be mistook, but I say our choir never looked as well since. Still, there was a lot found out about the history of the church, and no doubt but what it did stand in need of repair. There was very few winters past, but what we'd lose a pinnacle." Mr. Lake expressed his concurrence with Warby's views of restoration, but owned to a fear about this point lest the story proper should never be reached. Possibly this was perceptible in his manner. Warby hastened to reassure him. "Not but what I could carry on about that topic for hours at a time, and do so when I see my opportunity. But Dean Burscough, he was very set on the Gothic period, and nothing would serve him but everything must be made agreeable to that. And one morning after service he appointed for my father to meet him in the choir, and he came back after he'd taken off his robes in the vestry, and he got a roll of paper with him, and the verger that was then brought in a table, and they begun spreading it out on the table with prayer books to keep it down, and my father helped him, and he saw it was a picture of the inside of a choir in a cathedral. And the dean, he was a quick-spoken gentleman, he says, 'Well, Warby, what do you think of that?' 'Why,' says my father, 'I don't think I have the pleasure of knowing that view. Would that be Hereford Cathedral, Mr. Dean?' 'No, Warby,' says the dean, 'that's Southminster Cathedral as we hope to see it before many years.' 'Indeed, sir,' says my father, and that was all he did say, leastways to the dean. But he used to tell me he felt really faint in himself when he looked round our choir, as I can remember it, all comfortable and furnished like, and then see this nasty little dry picter, as he called it, drawn out by some London architect. Well, there I am again. But you'll see what I mean if you look at this old view.' Warby reached down a framed print from the wall. 'Well, the long and the short of it was that the dean, he handed over to my father a copy of an order of the chapter that he was to clear out every bit of the choir, make a clean sweep, ready for the new work that was being designed up in town. And he was to put it in hand as soon as ever he could get the breakers together. Now then, sir, if you look at that view, you'll see where the pulpit used to stand. That's what I want you to notice, if you please.' It was, indeed, easily seen. An unusually large structure of timber, with a domed sounding board, standing at the east end of the stalls on the north side of the choir facing the bishop's throne. Warby proceeded to explain that during the alterations, services were held in the nave, the members of the choir being thereby disappointed of an anticipated holiday, and the organist in particular incurring the suspicion of having wilfully damaged the mechanism of the temporary organ that was hired at considerable expense from London. The work of demolition began with the choir screens and organ loft, and proceeded gradually eastwards, disclosing, as Warby said, many interesting features of older work. While this was going on, the members of the chapter were, naturally, in and about the choir a great deal, and it soon became apparent to the elder Warby, who could not help overhearing some of their talk, that on the part of the senior canons especially, there must have been a good deal of disagreement before the policy now being carried out had been adopted. Some were of opinion that they should catch their deaths of cold in the return stalls, unprotected by a screen from the draughts in the nave. Others objected to being exposed to the view of persons in the choir aisles, especially, they said, during the sermons, when they found it helpful to listen in a posture which was liable to misconstruction. The strongest opposition, however, came from the oldest of the body, who up to the last moment objected to the removal of the pulpit. "You ought not to touch it, Mr. Dean," he said with great emphasis one morning when the two were standing before it. "You don't know what mischief you may do." "Mischief? It's not a work of any particular merit, Canon." "Don't call me Canon," said the old man with great asperity. "That is, for 30 years I've been known as Dr. Ayloff, and I shall be obliged, Mr. Dean, if you would kindly humour me in that matter. And as to the pulpit, which I've preached from for 30 years, though I don't insist on that, all I say is, I know you're doing wrong in moving it." "But what sense could there be, my dear doctor, in leaving it where it is, when we're fitting up the rest of the choir in a totally different style? What reason could be given, apart from the look of the thing?" "Reason? Reason!" said old Dr. Ayloff. "If you young men, if I may say so without any disrespect, Mr. Dean, if you'd only listen to reason a little and not be always asking for it, we should get on better. But there, I've had my say." The old gentleman hobbled off, and, as it proved, never entered the cathedral again. The season, it was a hot summer, turned sickly on a sudden. Dr. Ayloff was one of the first to go, with some affection of the muscles of the thorax, which took him painfully at night, and at many services the number of choir men and boys was very thin. Meanwhile the pulpit had been done away with. In fact, the sounding board, part of which still exists as a table in a summer-house in the palace garden, was taken down within an hour or two of Dr. Ayloff's protest. The removal of the base, not effected without considerable trouble, disclosed to view, greatly to the exultation of the restoring party, an altar tomb. The tomb, of course, to which Warby had attracted Lake's attention that same evening. Much fruitless research was expended in attempts to identify the occupant. From that day to this, he has never had a name put to him. The structure had been most carefully boxed in under the pulpit base, so that such slight ornament as it possessed was not defaced. Only on the north side of it there was what looked like an injury, a gap between two of the slabs composing the side. It might be 2 or 3 inches across. Palmer, the mason, was directed to fill it up in a week's time when he came to do some other small jobs near that part of the choir. The season was undoubtedly a very trying one. Whether the church was built on a site that had once been a marsh, as was suggested, or for whatever reason, the residents in its immediate neighbourhood had, many of them, but little enjoyment of the exquisite sunny days and the calm nights of August and September. To several of the older people, Dr. Ayloff among others, as we have seen, the summer proved downright fatal. But even among the younger, few escaped either a sojourn in bed for a matter of weeks, or at the least a brooding sense of oppression, accompanied by hateful nightmares. Gradually there formulated itself a suspicion, which grew into a conviction, that the alterations in the cathedral had something to say in the matter. The widow of a former old verger, a pensioner of the chapter of Southminster, was visited by dreams, which she retailed to her friends, of a shape that slipped out of the little door of the south transept as the dark fell in, and flitted, taking a fresh direction every night, about the close, disappearing for a while in house after house, and finally emerging again when the night sky was paling. She could see nothing of it, she said, but that it was a moving form. Only she had an impression that when it returned to the church, as it seemed to do in the end of the dream, it turned its head, and then, she could not tell why, but she thought it had red eyes. Warby remembered hearing the old lady tell this dream at a tea party in the house of the chapter clerk. Its recurrence might, perhaps, he said, be taken as a symptom of approaching illness. At any rate, before the end of September, the old lady was in her grave. The interest excited by the restoration of this great church was not confined to its own county. One day that summer, an FSA of some celebrity visited the place. His business was to write an account of the discoveries that had been made for the Society of Antiquaries, and his wife, who accompanied him, was to make a series of illustrative drawings for his report. In the morning she employed herself in making a general sketch of the choir. In the afternoon she devoted herself to details. She first drew the newly exposed altar tomb, and when that was finished, she called her husband's attention to a beautiful piece of diaper ornament on the screen just behind it, which had, like the tomb itself, been completely concealed by the pulpit. "Of course," he said, "an illustration of that must be made." So she seated herself on the tomb and began a careful drawing, which occupied her till dusk. Her husband had by this time finished his work of measuring and description, and they agreed that it was time to be getting back to their hotel. "You may as well brush my skirt, Frank," said the lady. "It must have got covered with dust, I'm sure." He obeyed dutifully, but after a moment he said, "I don't know whether you value this dress particularly, my dear, but I'm inclined to think it's seen its best days. There's a great bit of it gone." "Gone? Where?" said she. "I don't know where it's gone, but it's off at the bottom edge, behind here." She pulled it hastily into sight and was horrified to find a jagged tear extending some way into the substance of the stuff, very much, she said, as if a dog had rent it away. The dress was, in any case, hopelessly spoilt, to her great vexation, and though they looked everywhere, the missing piece could not be found. There were many ways, they concluded, in which the injury might have come about, for the choir was full of old bits of woodwork with nails sticking out of them. Finally, they could only suppose that one of these had caused the mischief, and that the workmen who had been about all day had carried off that particular piece with the fragment of dress still attached to it. It was about this time, Warby thought, that his little dog began to wear an anxious expression when the hour for it to be put into the shed in the backyard approached, for his mother had ordained that it must not sleep in the house. One evening, he said, when he was just going to pick it up and carry it out, it looked at him like a Christian, and waved its hand, and I was going to say, well, you know how they do carry on sometimes, and the end of it was I put it under my coat and huddled it upstairs, and I'm afraid I as good as deceived my poor mother on the subject. After that, the dog acted very artful with hiding itself under the bed for half an hour or more before bedtime came, and we worked it so as my mother never found out what we'd done. Of course, Warby was glad of its company anyhow, but more particularly when the nuisance that is still remembered in Southminster as the crying set in. "Night after night," said Warby, "that dog seemed to know it was coming. He'd creep out, he would, and snuggle into the bed and cuddle right up to me, shivering. And when the crying come, he'd be like a wild thing, shoving his head under my arm, and I was fully near as bad. 6 or 7 times we'd hear it, not more, and when he'd draw out his head again, I'd know it was over for that night. What was it like, sir? Well, I never heard but one thing that seemed to hit it off. I happened to be playing about in the close, and there was 2 of the canons met and said, 'Good morning,' one to another. 'Slept well last night,' says one. It was Mr. Henslow, that one, and Mr. Lyle was the other. 'Can't say I did,' says Mr. Lyle. 'Rather too much of Isaiah 34:14 for me.' 34:14, says Mr. Henslow. 'What's that?' 'You call yourself a Bible reader?' says Mr. Lyle. Mr. Henslow, you must know, he was one of what used to be termed Simeon's lot, pretty much what we should call the evangelical party. 'You go and look it up.' I wanted to know what he was getting at myself, and so off I ran home and got out my own Bible, and there it was. 'The satyr shall cry to his fellow.' Well, I thought, is that what we've been listening to these past nights? And I tell you, it made me look over my shoulder a time or two. Of course, I'd asked my father and mother about what it could be before that, but they both said it was most likely cats. But they spoke very short, and I could see they was troubled. My word, that was a noise. Hungry-like, as if it was calling after someone that wouldn't come. If ever you felt you wanted company, it would be when you was waiting for it to begin again. I believe 2 or 3 nights there was men put on to watch in different parts of the close, but they all used to get together in one corner, the nearest they could to the high street, and nothing came of it. Well, the next thing was this. Me and another of the boys, he's in business in the city now as a grocer, like his father before him, we'd gone up in the choir after morning service was over, and we heard old Palmer, the mason, bellowing to some of his men. So we went up nearer, because we knew he was a rusty old chap, and there might be some fun going. It appears Palmer told this man to stop up the chink in that old tomb. Well, there was this man keeping on saying he'd done it the best he could, and there was Palmer carrying on like all possessed about it. "Call that making a job of it," he says. "If you had your rights, you'd get the sack for this. What do you suppose I'll pay you your wages for? What do you suppose I'm going to say to the dean and chapter when they come round, as come they may do any time, and see where you've been bungling about covering the old place with mess and plaster and Lord knows what?" "Well, master, I done the best I could," says the man. "I don't know no more than what you do how it come to fall out this way. I tamped it right in the hole," he says, "and now it's fell out," he says. "I never see."